This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Healing Process. Lecture 10, entitled The Art of Healing from the Perspective of Spiritual Science, Number 1, given in London on August 28, 1924. I would especially like to express cordial thanks to Dr. and Mrs. Larkins for making it possible for me to repeat last year's presentation on the approach to medicine, human health and illness, and therapeutic procedures that is based on the anthroposophical worldview and methods of research. Let me first say a few words of introduction. The contributions of anthroposophy, as the term is used here, to various aspects of life, such as medicine, are not intended to contradict modern scientific medical views in any way. When speaking from the perspectives I have chosen for tonight and tomorrow evening, I know that I am likely to be misunderstood because of the prevalent contemporary view that any approach not limiting itself to so-called hard facts is automatically sectarian and cannot be taken seriously from the scientific point of view. For this reason, I would like to note at the very outset that the anthroposophical view of medicine not only fully acknowledges, but also completely understands all the great and significant accomplishments of modern medicine. It is unthinkable that anything I say should be construed as a dilettantish or amateurish polemic against currently sanctioned methods of healing, or the like. It is simply a fact, however, that in the course of the past few centuries our entire worldview has assumed a form that limits research to subjects accessible to our senses, either in experiments or in direct observation, and to what our human reason synthesizes on the basis of sensory perception. For centuries, research of this sort was fully justified because humanity would have succumbed completely to dreams and fantasies, arbitrary assumptions and chaotic hypotheses, if we had persisted in our old ways. Nonetheless, it is also true that our senses and our reason cannot really completely grasp the human being in this world between birth and death. The human being has a suprasensible aspect that is just as real as the sense-perceptible aspect. When we talk about human health and illness, we inevitably wonder whether it is altogether possible to understand health and illness as we attempt to grasp them today by simply investigating the physical body with the help of the tools of our reason, our senses, technological extensions of our senses, and experimental techniques. An unbiased consideration of history teaches us that our insight into the human being initially emerged from an element completely different from mere sensory observation. After all, we have a long history of development behind us, even with regard to our intellectual and cultural life. 3,000 years ago, when ancient Greece was at its peak, there were no schools where people could learn the way we learn today. Modern education assumes that the psychological makeup of young people entering our colleges and universities is finished and complete. These young people are introduced to various scientific disciplines, such as pre-medical courses of study, which they are expected to appraise according to the psychological level of development of 18 to 20-year-olds. In ancient times, learning did not take this approach, but instead assumed that forces first had to evolve in people's souls that would allow them to continue to grow and educate themselves with the goal of understanding the essence of the human being. Because the more primitive soul state of people in ancient times did not permit fantasizing tendencies, students of the so-called mysteries were able to master all aspects of life on the basis of such spiritual training or spiritual discipline. This approach ceased when our universities were founded in the 12th through 14th centuries. Since that time, we learn only through rationalistic methods. The rationalism that leads to clear logic, however, also leads us to see only outer material aspects. It cannot be denied that in recent times, that is, in the past few centuries, we have accumulated huge quantities of valid sense-based information in biology, physiology, and all other pre-medical subjects. The accumulation of knowledge has been so great that we have not yet managed to categorize all the individual observations from which so much remains to be learned. These few centuries, however, have also seen the retreat of the view that the human soul must also learn to see the suprasensible. As a result, real research into human health and illness has become impossible. To confirm what I have just said, I would like to point out that it is indeed possible today to guide the human soul toward an understanding of the spiritual aspect of the human being as opposed to the material or physical aspect. I have discussed this possibility in my books, including titled How to Know Higher Worlds. The spiritual aspect of the human being is as perceptible to spiritual observation as the physical material aspect is to sensory observation. The organic basis of sense perception, however, develops naturally and without any effort on our part, while spiritual perception must be acquired. This spiritual perception comes about not through nebulous mystical exercises, but by cultivating a life of pure thought. The process of resting on or dwelling in a thought must be transformed methodically into exercises that educate the soul. In a process similar to physical experimentation, we experiment with our soul, allowing it to dwell on an easily surveyed thought without succumbing to autosuggestion, self-hypnosis, or any other state of reduced consciousness. We perform exercises that build on the accomplishments of ordinary thinking, retaining our full presence of mind. In a process that corresponds to the physical phenomenon of a muscle growing stronger with exercise, the human soul becomes stronger and perceives differently as a result of this methodical activation. The soul's first new perception is that the human being includes not only a physical body, which can be examined either with the naked eye or with a microscope or other instruments, but also an etheric body. Please do not take exception to the term etheric body. The choice of terminology is somewhat arbitrary, but we do need to have a name for this entity. In a human being, we perceive an etheric body in addition to the ordinary physical body, whose structure can be studied by contemporary anatomy and physiology. The etheric body is not identical to the, in quotes, life force amateurishly imagined during earlier stages in the development of science. It is truly perceptible, truly visible. I will select one of the numerous qualitative differences between the etheric body and the physical body as an example. The human physical body is subject to gravity and tends to move toward the earth, while the human etheric body tends to move outward in all directions toward the periphery of the cosmos. Because modern researchers like to measure weight, they focus on weighty entities. The weighty aspect of the human organism, however, is counteracted by an entity that not only is not heavy, but also actively counters the Earth's ordinary force of gravity and attempts to escape from the Earth. We incorporate not only forces of weight, but also forces of levity, forces that move away from the Earth. The etheric body is the first suprasensible body. I could list many more of its etheric characteristics, but I will restrict myself to the one I already mentioned. Each human being comprises not only the first human body, the physical human being, which is centripetally oriented toward the earth and tends to move toward the earth, but also a second body that is centrifugal in its orientation and tends to move away from the earth. Our life, as we know it, depends on maintaining the balance between these two aspects of our human constitution, between the heavy physical body that is subject to gravity and the second, etheric body, that attempts to move out into the cosmos in all directions. Think about this configuration of physical and etheric forces. As we have seen, the etheric body strives to move outward in all directions. In effect, it always wants to be as big as the entire universe. The physical body, on the other hand, is subject to gravity and heaviness and seeks to move toward the Earth's center. It restrains the etheric body, which imitates the cosmos, so that it conforms to limits imposed by the physical body. By considering the balance between the physical body and the etheric body, we achieve a truly realistic and penetrating view of the human being. Now, let's move on. Once we can visualize the centrifugal etheric forces that attempt to move away from the earth, we also begin to find them in plants. Minerals alone are exclusively physical, with no trace of centrifugal forces. Minerals are completely subject to gravity, while the physically perceptible forms of plants result from both types of forces. It becomes apparent, however, that more than two types are required to account for organisms higher on the evolutionary ladder than plants. Each plant has its etheric body, but each animal has perceptions. The animal creates its own inner world, alerting us to the need to expand our investigations. We can indeed develop our consciousness to an even greater extent than is required in order to see the human physical body, not only in isolation but also embedded in the etheric body as if in a cloud. The etheric body, however, is not all there is to the human being. Just as we can strengthen our arm muscles through regular exertion, we can also strengthen our soul so that its thoughts encompass ever more reality. Having done so, we can move on to an exercise that is more difficult, namely suppressing the thoughts we made an effort to strengthen. As you can easily confirm through experimentation, if we gradually eliminate vision, hearing, our other senses, and our thinking from our ordinary consciousness, we fall asleep. But if we first strengthen the soul through thought exercises that train our entire conceptual and emotional activity, we can then suppress this activity. When we do so, we enter a state in which we are not asleep, but very much awake. In fact, when we cultivate this state, we must be careful not to lose the ability to fall asleep. Proceeding as I describe in my books, however, ensures that we take all the necessary precautions to prevent such disturbances. We manage to be very much awake, but without seeing, hearing, or having other sensory perceptions. We also succeed in eliminating ordinary memory, and we confront the world with our consciousness empty but fully awake. When we have done so, we perceive a third body in the human being. I call this body the astral body, and once again I ask you not to take exception to the terminology. Animals also have such a body. This body enables human beings to transcend the level of the etheric body and its centrifugal forces, and to develop a real inner life of perception and sensation. This third member of the human constitution is related neither to the depths of the earth nor the breadth of the cosmos. It is imbued with still different forces. I will tell you about the fourth member later, but first I want to tell you about the third member. Learning about the third member in the way I have outlined is tremendously illuminating from the scientific standpoint. It is as if the scales suddenly fall from our eyes. Before this moment, any unbiased thinking would have led us to the conclusion that we encounter a sheer impossibility when we observe human growth. We can see how children whose vital forces are active grow and grow. But in addition to growing, they also develop consciousness, an internal reflection of the outer world. Can consciousness be derived from growth? Can it come from the forces underlying the processes of nutrition and growth? In reality, our consciousness is dulled when the organic forces underlying nutrition and growth gain the upper hand in us. That is, our consciousness is dulled immediately when hypertrophy of the growth forces occurs and the forces of nutrition predominate. We need something that counteracts these forces rather than coinciding with them. We continue to grow and take in nourishment, but the astral body I described constantly suppresses and breaks down our processes of growth and nutrition. In the human being, therefore, we see earth-related and cosmic generative and regenerative effects in the physical body and etheric body, respectively, and ongoing degeneration in the astral body. The astral body constantly deconstructs organic processes, breaking down the activity of our cells, glands, and so on. This is the secret that explains why the human being has a soul. If we continue to grow like plants, we would have no soul. Growth processes must be broken down, because they repel the soul. If growth or regeneration occurred unceasingly in our brains, we would each be incapable of receiving a soul. Evolution never takes place in a straight line, but must always regress to make room for a new element. Degeneration is necessary. This is the secret of the human constitution and of every ensouled being. I would like to present the spiritual physiology and spiritual biology of the human being today, and then proceed tomorrow to describe individual diseases and the processes that cure them. As long as we remain on the animal level of organization, we are dealing with the three bodies I already mentioned, physical, etheric, and astral. If we apply the same degree of soul training to perceiving a human being, however, spiritual perception reveals an additional level of organization. Spiritual insight into the animal kingdom shows us that thinking, feeling, and willing in animals are not clearly separated. They neutralize each other, so to speak. True insight reveals that animals do not possess separate faculties of thinking, feeling, and willing, but only a neutral mixture of these three elements. Human psychology, however, is based on the ability to formulate intentions in the quiet of thoughts, and then to act or refrain from acting on these intentions. When an animal has an impulse, it acts on it immediately. In contrast, human beings separate their thinking, feeling, and willing. We clearly understand this phenomenon only when we expand our inner soul vision to perceive the fourth member of the human constitution, the I being, capital I. In the human being, therefore, we distinguish a physical body, an etheric body, an astral body, which we have in common with animals, and finally the I, capital, itself. We have just become aware that the astral body breaks down growth processes and retards the forces of nourishment, thus incorporating a slow dying into the human organism. The I-being rescues certain elements from this breakdown and begins rebuilding using degenerating substances that have fallen out of the etheric body and physical body. This is the secret of the human constitution. When we observe a human brain, we see that the lighter colored parts lying deeper below the surface are made up of nerve strands coming from the sense organs. To understand this admittedly very complicated structure clearly, we must realize that it is breaking down, although the degenerative process may be too slow to trace by any crude physiological means. In human beings, and this is one aspect distinguishing us from animals, this degenerating structure serves to build up the peripheral brain, which underlies our overall human organization. The central brain, which includes the continuation of the sensory nerves and their connections, is actually the most highly perfected part of the human body. While the outer layer of the brain, which underlies our ordinary human organization, is more closely related to metabolism. The I-being rescues this uniquely human peripheral or frontal brain from the degeneration it would otherwise undergo. We encounter parallel phenomena throughout the human body. The I rescues certain elements from the decline caused by the astral body and uses them to build the foundations for the harmonious coordination of thinking, feeling, and willing in the human being. Of course, I can mention these subjects only briefly, but I do want to point out that our spiritual research can indeed proceed as exactly as any science that investigates physical phenomena. Our sense of responsibility constantly forces us to ask whether our spiritual perceptions coincide with the results of physical empirical research. If they do not, they are assumed to be invalid, at least in principle. The very structure of the brain points to a fact that is confirmed by spiritual perception, namely that three of the members of the human constitution, the physical body, etheric body, and astral body, are underlaid by the I-being, which reconstructs and re-enlivens a parasite of sorts out of products of degeneration. Thus the human organism has four members, and these members must be present in very specific proportions in the healthy human body. Let me use a scientific analogy to illustrate this statement. Water is produced only when we combine hydrogen and oxygen in specific proportions by weight. When the proportions are different, water is not created. Water comes about only when the proportion of oxygen to hydrogen is correct. In the parallel phenomenon, in the human being, the proportions among physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I are normal. There are not only four proportions that come into question, but four times four, and any one of them can become disturbed. The etheric body may predominate, for example. Although living matter is distinguished from dead by the presence of a certain balance between the physical and etheric bodies, this balance is unstable. Water simply does not come about if the proportion of oxygen to hydrogen Water simply does not come about if the proportion of oxygen to hydrogen is incorrect. But in the human body, an abnormal proportion can develop between the etheric body and the physical body, the astral body and the etheric body, or the eye and any one of the other members. All four members are interconnected in specific proportions. When these proportions are disturbed, the organism is diseased. Although we can determine the correct proportions, they are not the same throughout the entire body, but are different in each human organ. Let's consider the human lungs. In the lungs, the proportions that exist among the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I-being are different than they are in the brain or the liver. The fact that the spiritual and material elements are present in each human organ in different proportions is what makes our human organization so complicated. I will go into specifics tomorrow, but I would like to give an overview today. Generally speaking, too much astrality may be present in an organ such as the liver or kidneys. Specific relationships among the physical kidney, the etheric body, the astral body, and the eye support health in the human organism. It is possible, however, for the astral organization to predominate in the kidneys, or it may be too weak. Both conditions signify disease in the kidneys. Excessive weakness or strength of the astral organization, however, is defined differently from organ to organ. Once we have achieved a general level of spiritual perception through practice, we must study the human organism. We must observe and recognize sickness and health in each organ just as precisely as physically oriented anatomists and physiologists study the human body's physical characteristics. Through this study, we gradually achieve complete knowledge of the human organism. We cannot understand the human body simply by being familiar with its physical structure. We must take all four of its members into account. And we clearly understand the nature of an illness only when we can state that one of the four members either predominates or is underactive in a particular location. By learning to perceive such phenomena by means of spiritual vision, we arrive at a spiritual diagnosis in addition to the material diagnosis. It is out of the question for the emerging field of anthroposophical medicine to ignore any of the remedies or methods of conventional medicine. On the contrary, this new field supplements conventional medicine with an appraisal of the healthy or sick individual based on insight into the four members of the human constitution. Spiritual vision can be applied not only to the human being, but to the entire natural world, adding a spiritual understanding of nature to our ordinary physical level of understanding. Spiritual insight enables us to discover the connections between the human being and nature, and with regard to medicine, between the human being and remedies derived from nature. Let's consider one such remedy. Silica is a very common substance on earth. It is present not only in the form of quartz crystals in the earth's solid regions, but also in highly dilute form in the air. Silica makes up 28% of the substance of the earth's surface, while oxygen makes up 48%. So there is almost as much silica on earth as there is oxygen. Silica forms beautiful, transparent, six-sided prisms or pyramids. These crystals are commonly found in our mountains. The particularly beautiful ones are displayed in mineral collections. Silica is an extremely important component of our solid earth. But for those who have also acquired spiritual vision, the outer phenomena of quartz and silica also reveal a spiritual aspect. Such a statement raises the hackles of our contemporaries even more than speaking about spirit in the human being, which is somehow more acceptable to them. They cannot accept it, however, when we talk about nature and say that spirit is present in every natural object. They are content with nature's physical manifestations, but physical manifestations do not tell the whole story. It makes a tremendous difference whether we apply our spiritual vision and trained consciousness to a quartz crystal, or even very finely dispersed silica, or to carbon dioxide gas. It is customary today to apply the usual physical distinctions. Carbon dioxide is carbon plus oxygen. Silicon is silica plus oxygen. We describe the oxygen, silicon, and carbon in terms of the properties they reveal in chemical reactions taking place in test tubes in laboratories. In addition to all these properties, however, spirit is also present. In fact, all forms of silica, including the crystals we find in our mountainous regions, allow the spirit free passage. All spiritual forces that are active in the universe pass freely through silica. The strange thing about a quartz crystal is that to spirit it is like a through station to an express train. 28% of the earth's total substance is silica, and spirit passes through it as readily as light passes through transparent objects. Quartz crystals also occur in opaque forms, such as smoky topaz, but spirit passes right through them, even though light does not. These natural substances allow spirit to pass through. They are a vehicle for spirit. Spirit is present within them. They accept it readily, yet never hold it back. They are truly through stations for spirit. This is how substances like silica relate to the spiritual element. But the relationship is a very different one in the case of carbon dioxide. Although all physical substances contain spirit, carbon dioxide has the unique quality of individualizing the spirit that enters it. Carbon dioxide attempts to hold spirit fast with all its might. The spiritual element itself seeks out carbon dioxide as its dwelling place. When the spiritual element enters a siliceous substance, it wants to move on, to enjoy all the available silica to the utmost. When spirit encounters carbon dioxide, however, it wants to stay there. It feels very much at home wherever it takes hold of carbon dioxide. This phenomenon is the basis of the carbon dioxide process in animal respiration and blood circulation, a process associated primarily with the astral body, which is constantly at work there. In the animal, the activity of carbon dioxide is the external physical aspect, while the astral body is the spirit working within. The spiritual aspect is the astral body, and its physical correlate is the carbon dioxide process that underlies exhalation. In contrast, the I-being is the internalized spiritual aspect in human beings. We have silica in our hair, bones, and sense organs. It is distributed throughout the periphery of the body, wherever we have contact with the forces of the outer world in any way. This silica is the physical correlate of the I, capital. Where the astral body is the internalized spiritual aspect, the carbon dioxide process is its outer physical correlate. Where the I-being is the internalized aspect, the silica process is its outer physical correlate. As you can imagine, the I-being must be strong enough to assimilate and master all the silica activity that is present in it. When the I-being is too weak to do so, the silica process falls out of it on the physical level. This constitutes a disease. Similarly, the astral body must be strong enough to master the carbon dioxide process. If it is not, carbon dioxide or its breakdown products fall out of the astral body, triggering illness. When we diagnose strength or weakness in the astral body, we see the spiritual element as the cause of an illness. Becoming familiar with the human I-being shows us the root of all illnesses that induce appropriate breakdown of silica in the body or that need to be treated using silica forces. What follows from these insights? The purely physical natural sciences allow us to process silica to use as a remedy. Using silica in this way is not unknown. Modern medicine uses it, although infrequently. When we use silica in conventional medicine, however, we are thinking only of how chemists imagine this compound of silicon and oxygen, SiO2. That is all we think about. In fact, however, the physical silica we administer as a remedy is a substance that does not restrain spirit, but allows it to pass through freely. We need to be aware of this fact. When we give people silica as a remedy, our methods of producing the preparation must enable it to contain spirit in the right way. Similarly, we must be aware that the astral body is at work in remedies containing carbon dioxide. Thus, we can conceive of a therapy that does not work exclusively with chemical agents and chemical forces. Of remedies we can prescribe knowing that spirit enters the human organism in a very specific way, along with the dose of physical substance, or a certain dilution of physical substance, that we administer orally, topically, or by injection. We can indeed make the transition to acknowledging not only the physical substance in the remedy, but also the spiritual factor active in it. This insight was an intrinsic part of ancient medicine, and the tradition persists in some important remedies still in use today. We must return to this level of insight. We can do so without neglecting physical medicine if we supplement our understanding of the physical aspects of the human being and the natural world with an understanding of their spiritual aspects. This can be done with all the precision of the physical sciences. The intention of anthroposophy is not to correct, but simply to supplement conventional medicine in response to the actual needs and demands of that field. A book presenting the first elements of anthroposophical medicine is currently being printed. When it comes out, you'll be convinced of anthroposophy's intentions with regard to medicine. Footnote, title Extending Practical Medicine, Fundamental Principles Based on the Science of the Spirit, Collected Works, Volume 27. I'll just mention, it's not on there, but it was co-written with Dr. Ita Wegman. End of footnote. Of course, anthroposophical medicine will need to be worked out slowly and systematically. It will take a long time to develop the initial elements into a perfected system, such as that of conventional modern medicine. We must and will go forward, however. And the first step is this book, which developed out of a collaboration between me and Dr. Ita Wegman, my dear friend and co-worker in both medical and general spiritual research, and the director of the Gertianum's Clinical Therapeutic Institute. The first volume of our book constitutes a beginning. Additional volumes will follow, because what I have pointed out to you here today is just the initial stages of a broader spiritual knowledge. Although today this knowledge is generally greeted with disbelief, and understandably so, it is the basis of our medical successes, which can be studied in actual practice at Dr. Wegman's clinic. I am convinced that our spiritual understanding of both the human being and specific methods of healing will not remain inaccessible to anyone who approaches our extensions and additions to the field of medicine with the same goodwill that is typically applied to conventional medicine. Today I have simply attempted to present general principles. I know very well that there is little to be gained from such indications, but in the third part of this lecture, after this section has been translated, I want to move on to demonstrating how our suppositions allow us to understand specific disease processes and provide a foundation for bridging the gap between diagnosis and treatment. Let me give you two brief examples to elucidate the spiritual and practical ramifications of what I have already presented. Let's assume that spiritual diagnosis, if I may call it that, shows that a person's etheric body predominates in a particular part of the body, and that its activity is too strong. Spiritual vision confronts us with the fact that the etheric body is working too hard in one organ. Neither degeneration by the astral body nor re-enlivening by the I being controls the etheric body's overwhelming process in this particular organ. We see an astral organization that is too weak, and possibly also an inadequately directed I-being. Consequently, the etheric body predominates in this particular organ. The processes of growth and nutrition are so forceful that the human organism is inadequately controlled by the astral body and the I. At this spot, in the dominant etheric body, the human body seems too strongly exposed to centrifugal forces working out into the cosmos. These forces, which are active in the etheric body, are out of balance with the centripetal forces of the physical body, and the astral body cannot control the resulting developments. In this case, we are faced with both a predominance of the activity of silica and the I-being's inability to control it. Such phenomena, which are always present when tumors develop, enable us to truly understand cancer. As you may know, cancer research has resulted in some very promising treatments, and its successes are as great as any that are possible on a physical level. But we cannot understand cancers as long as we do not know that they involve a predominance of the etheric body that is not forced back or broken down by appropriate activity of the astral body or I-being. Then the question arises of what we must do to strengthen the astral body and I in this particular organ so that the predominance of the etheric body can be adequately broken down. This is an initial abstract formulation of the question that set us on the path to the cancer therapy that I will discuss tomorrow. In this instance, understanding the etheric body opens a way for us to learn to comprehend one of the worst human illnesses and to combat it by discerning the spiritual effects of remedies. This is an example of a case where we must look at the etheric body in order to understand the illness completely. Next, let's assume that the astral body predominates throughout most of the body. We see a general stiffening of the astral body, so to speak. It becomes excessively forceful, and it takes itself more seriously than it deserves in the context of the entire organism. What are the consequences when the astral body cannot be controlled by the eye, when its degenerative processes are not neutralized and balanced by appropriate re-enlivening? The resulting symptoms have to do primarily with weakness of the eye being, because when the astral body is too strong, the eye is proportionally too weak. Symptoms that stem from weakness of the eye are also always related to an excessively strong astral body. Chief among these symptoms is abnormal cardiac activity, so we must look for a syndrome that includes it. Another consequence of eye activity that is too weak, in proportion to the astral body, is increased glandular activity. The functions of glands close to the body's surface begin to predominate, because they are inadequately controlled by the eye being. For example, goiter may develop, causing swelling of the glands in the throat. In addition, because the eye organization is unable to work strongly enough, especially in the sensory organs, the stiffening of the astral body forces the activity of silica outward, which should, instead, work back from within. Consequently, we find that the patient's eyes protrude. The astral body forces the eyes outward, and the function of the eye is to counteract this protruding tendency. Our eyes are held in place by the stable but delicate balance between the eye being and the astral body. When a patient's eyes protrude as if attempting to escape from the body, we know that the eye being is too weak to keep them in their proper place. Other symptoms, such as general restlessness, sensitivity, and nervousness, also indicate a preponderance of the astral body's activity, because the eye cannot adequately repress the organic processes the astral body induces. When the eye is too weak, and the patient is pushed around by the astral body, which should be subordinate to the eye, the symptoms include insomnia, protruding eyes, and abnormal glandular activity. In short, the symptoms of Graves' disease, hyperthyroidism, or exophthalmic goiter. Having realized that Graves' disease is induced by a disturbance in the balance between eye and astral body, we can attempt to develop an appropriate treatment. As you see, both the pathological condition and its treatment can be studied with great precision with the help of spiritual insight into the human being. I have now completed my introduction and hope to move on tomorrow, using the two examples I have just given, to demonstrate how spiritual diagnostics leads to spiritual treatments. I will use the two characteristic syndromes of cancer and Graves' disease to show how a truly exact spiritual foundation for both pathology and treatment enriches and complements conventional medical therapies. Treatments for these two syndromes will serve as the basis for providing a more complete picture of therapy in general. The end of Lecture 10.